Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper recovering from his back injury. He's making great progress, and we're looking forward to his return. The pinging of an email, the ringing of a cell phone, the dinging of a new text, the buzzing of a pager. Yes, doctors still use pagers. Our tweets, our Facebook updates, downloading new music to our iPods, getting a new request on LinkedIn, compulsively doing another Google search, being constantly connected, we're consumed by our digital lives. Okay, I have to breathe. Well, have you ever attempted to unplug for an hour? What about a whole day? Or how about an entire month? Our guest, in spite of the pain, did just that last year. This experience was the impetus for his latest book, The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. Award-winning journalist Michael Harris joins us via landline from Toronto. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Have you shut off all your digital devices for our conversation?
I closed them all and put them in the other room. Hopefully we'll be okay.
Okay, good. Well, let's begin with that moment in your life when you decided to disconnect. What happened?
Sure. I mean, I was working as a magazine editor at the time. And as you know, in journalism, it can sometimes be about reacting to content more than creating content. You get kind of overwhelmed by this digital deluge. And I was working in an office with two monitors on my desk. I had my phone constantly pinging by my side. I was spending most of my life staring at glowing rectangles, I figured out. And one day I was at work, and somebody had been waiting for a text message from me, maybe for 3 minutes. And impatient, they sent me a message that just said, "Are you alive or what?" And I remember looking down at that message, and I ended up in the moment reading it literally and looking up at my screens and kind of having this sort of aha moment. Like, this is not my life. I'm not really living. I've been suckered into this somehow. And I eventually quit my job. And as you mentioned, I took a month off from the internet, and that was the beginning of working on that book, The End of Absence.
Well, tell us about your withdrawal process, which is what you call it. What was that like?
Well, I mean, for the first 2 weeks or so, I would say, I was really going through withdrawal symptoms. Yeah, I was so desirous of social connection that I was actually dreaming of text messages. And every time I had a question, I wanted to run to the phone or run to the laptop. And it was, I think, more than anything else, it was lonely, actually, going through that. And it never quite went away. My brain's been so hardwired toward constant connection that I was always having those symptoms.
So you say it never went away, you mean with the withdrawal symptoms?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, they got a little bit better by the end of the month, I guess, but really, more than anything, taking that month off, that digital detox, it was a way to show myself just how addicted I had actually become.
So is that, what do you feel you accomplished? Is that what you felt you accomplished, that you learned how addicted you were? And
yeah.
Well, what did you actually hope for or expect to happen during that month?
You know, it's the same thing as when people take a month off from sugar or a month off from gluten. Those food diets that we have in an environment where we have a superabundance of sugars and fats and oils, it's like a way to reset your body. And I think similarly, if you take a month off from the internet or a month off from your cell phone, it's like a way to reset your mind or a way to reset your life itself. And I think that's ultimate. I knew that there wasn't going to be some sort of epiphany and where I would end up wandering off and living in a cave for the rest of my life. I knew I always was going to be living with these communication technologies, but what I wanted was to become more awake to the way that they were affecting my life.
And did that happen?
It did happen. Yeah, I mean, when I go online, when I check my email now, like I'm much more awake to it. I mean, not just because I took the month off, but because I spent, you know, a year and a half writing this book, so that probably has something to do with it too.
Right. So, how long did it take your brain to readapt to being not bombarded, to the lack of bombardment, once you took this month off?
Oh, you mean how hard was it to come back online?
No, I know about that. We're going to get to that. But how hard was it to disconnect for your brain? I mean, you said you went through withdrawal symptoms, but yeah. The brain itself, I'm just wondering, you know, you said you read War and Peace in 2 weeks. So obviously your brain could slow down.
Eventually it did, yes. I would say the first 2 weeks were a bit of a torture. And then, you begin going on longer walks. You begin realizing you can still connect with your friends. You just can't spend 50 messages trying to set up a drink date. You make a plan on the phone, and then that's it. Your life eventually, I mean, we lived perfectly well for many, many years before we had these communication technologies. And when you throw yourself back into a vacation in 1985, it takes a little while, but eventually you start to get the hang of it. And ultimately, it's your friends and family who start having more of a problem with it, I think, because you're the one opting out, and they can't get in touch with you.
Right. Well, you had your landline, and you said if people wanted to get in touch with you, they had to leave a message on your landline, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So they had to adapt. So referencing the title of your book, The End of Absence, tell us what you think is the value of absence, you know, solitude, silence. What does that do for us?
Well, it's a very good question, because absence has become, I think, this boogeyman for a lot of us. Solitude, reverie, daydreaming, these are things we're actually afraid of now. And it's something we don't know how to deal with. We get very uncomfortable when we encounter that empty moment, and we dive into the phone looking for some kind of distraction. But I think if we work through that discomfort, if we break away from a world of retweets and Facebook likes, we can start to develop a rich interior life. And that rich interior life is actually the only way that we can start making our own personal decisions about the things that we encounter out in the world. If we're constantly connected, then it's a little bit like behaving in a hive mind mentality, a kind of groupthink. And it's only through solitude that we can begin to craft our own ideas about things instead of just repeating what we see online.
I was thinking about this so much, you know, since I started reading the book, and I think another thing maybe that we sacrifice is our self-awareness, because how do we get to know ourselves, and then anybody else for that matter, without an inner life?
That's such a good point. I think that, you know, there's an approval system online. When you post something on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, you get these likes and you get comments from your friends, and the things that we put out into the online world become gilded with approval systems, and
right.
It's very attractive, right?
Right.
And that's very different from self-approval or self-esteem, where you have to build your own approval system. So you're absolutely right.
So one of the people you talk about so many people, but And just to set the record straight here, you're not what's referred to as a Luddite or anti-technology, are you?
I mean, I've been called a Luddite a couple times, but I think that people who use that word sometimes don't know who the actual Luddites were.
Well, tell us about them, because I learned that in your book.
Well, they weren't people who were anti-technology. It's really a mistake to say that. They weren't anti-tech. They were pro-human. These were people who were under the heel of a manufacturing elite, and what they wanted was to safeguard all of those rights that all of our unions today are safeguarding. They were really, in a way, a progenitor of the union ethic. In a similar vein, I think, in my book, the idea isn't to say technology bad or technology good. The idea is just to say technology is dangerous, and incredibly useful also, and we need to be intelligent about the way that we use it.
Something that occurred to me is that, you know, it seems like instead of controlling our use of technology, we are, for the most part, being controlled by it. And, you know, maybe that's one. I mean, could we say that, you know, it's simplistic, but do you agree with that?
I do, absolutely. I mean, it's only been a couple of decades since the cell phone was invented, and we now have a one-to-one ratio for cell phones and people on the planet. There's about 7 billion active cell phone accounts. So that's a massive shift that's taken place. And I think when you have massive shifts like that, it takes a while for us to catch up. So we do end up getting used by our technologies, sometimes more than used by them, or we more than we use them.
Right.
And that's, I think by the end of the book, that's sort of the call to action, is that we need to develop for ourselves, we have to be active about developing healthy media diets, and we can't simply allow ourselves to be passively responding to our technologies.
Well, we're going to get more into that. We're speaking with Michael Harris. He's an award-winning journalist and a contributing editor at Western Living and Vancouver Magazines, and is based in Toronto, Canada. And we're going to take a short break. We'll come back, and we'll open the phones and emails and tweets. Stay with us.
Are you recording me? Oh. I can't hear the snare. Count me in.
Twitter.
Where do I go when I don't have a friend? Where do I go at another day's end? Nobody loves me, somebody loves me on
Twitter.
I think I'm a big, big loser. Then I go to my computer, turn it on, and I feel grand, all because of
Twitter.
Direct message me. Please, please message me. Or at least reply to my
Twitter.
Tweet, 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 tweet.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with Michael Harris, an award-winning journalist, contributing editor at Western Living and Vancouver Magazines. And he's written The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. And, well, if you'd like to join in the conversation, maybe you consider yourself a digital junkie, maybe you don't. Are you able to disconnect? Have you tried and failed? Well, you can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio at WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. So, Michael, something that surprised me, your entry, re-entry into the digital world was anything but subtle or gradual. Tell us what happened.
Right. So I had basically become the perfect boyfriend by the time the month was up. My boyfriend would come home, and I would lavish him with attention. I was so happy to have somebody to connect with because I'd been disconnected all day. And we now know that you can really love somebody if there is a quality of solitude in your life too. You need to be going back and forth, right? You can't just be obsessively connected. So what happened at the end of my month off was I opened up my laptop that night and I dived into, you know, obviously there were just hundreds of emails waiting for me, and it was like getting a hit of a drug that I had been kept from for so long. And I became immediately the worst boyfriend in the world. I was giving him one-word answers while, like, diving into my phone and diving into my laptop, and I was just giddy and, like, reeling with this digital connection. And it ended up leading to a big fight, actually. So I guess the lesson of all that was that a month off isn't going to fix you. The only thing it can do is make you awake to the way that you're behaving, the way that you're treating each other.
Just one question. During those lonely days, that you spent. Why didn't you connect with other friends, you know, during the day? Maybe they were all working. I don't know. But
yeah, they had jobs.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's a good reason.
They had jobs, and also, you know, everybody is, it's already become this point where everyone's online, and if you opt out of that, then you are forcing yourself to miss out. So there's a kind of conspiracy to connect in a way. I'm not on Facebook, for example. I am on Twitter, but I'm not on Facebook. And I have missed out on news about people's weddings. I've missed out on news about actually even the deaths of one friend's father, because they will put this on Facebook and assume that everybody's on Facebook.
Right, exactly.
So there was a real derailment of my social life.
During that month.
And that month, exactly.
But your boyfriend, I'm sure, was connected during that month, correct?
Yes, he was running along business as usual.
So why did you end up, you know, why was he so surprised when you threw yourself back into it?
I think because, you know, I was being... I had changed. He hadn't changed. So he was enjoying the benefits of a boyfriend that was, attentive and had all this extra time to do things like make dinner or clean up, you know. And so it led to a fight, because when I went back online, he suddenly lost out on all those benefits, I guess.
That's interesting. So you call this the straddle generation, among which you're a member. Would you explain what that is?
Sure. I mean, there's this idea that we're moving through a Gutenberg moment, i.e. a moment where a new communication technology just revolutionizes our lives. And what's interesting for me is the fact that this moment is happening within a single lifetime. I'm 34 years old. I was born in 1980, and I think my peers and anybody older than me, we're sort of this last generation to know life before the internet, and yet we also are online now. So we're straddling these two worlds of before and after. Meanwhile, anyone born after 1985 doesn't have access to that pre-internet brain. They haven't been adults in a pre-internet world. So there's a kind of cognitive dissonance between our two cultures, I guess you could say.
Do you think the brains of those that came after 1985 developed differently than in previous generations? Did you find in your research?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a brain scientist, so I
can't
speak to it too much, but I've spoken to brain scientists. And that seems to be the consensus that, there's continuing work in neuroplasticity research, which suggests that, yes, spending time online literally rewires your brain. It makes you more likely to read things in a shallow way and unable to read deeply. It makes you obviously more distracted. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics has issued limits on the amount of screen time that our children and our babies even should have, limits that nobody really meets. Babies 2 years old and under are not supposed to have any screen time, and yet you constantly see babies playing with iPhones and looking at TVs. And children older than two are supposed to have no more than 2 hours of screen time a day. But the actual average in America is something like 6 to 8 hours a day for children. And that's not even counting multitasking when they're watching TV while tweeting, right? Which is compounding the problem.
Right. And you're saying who came out with this recommendation?
That was the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, or American Association of Pediatrics. I'm not sure which way they say it.
Okay. Well, let's just take a quick call here from John. Who wants to talk about his use of social media. Hi, John.
Hey, hi there. How's it going?
Good. Welcome.
Well, so I just wanted to state that my experience has been totally opposite than your guest. I've been dragged kicking and screaming into the digital age. I'm very independent, very introverted, and very opinionated. And I totally do not like the idea of being dictated as to what my content should be or what someone is trying to sell me. So I'm very, you know, I like multiple opinions on various subjects. And so I do have a dumb phone, not a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
I have a desktop, which, you know, I access the Wall Street Journal and things like that on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite capable of reading a book, so, or multiple books at once. So I would just wanted to say that where I'm coming from, it was actually quite easy to disengage from the media. And as a matter of fact, I happen to be Jewish, so like every Sabbath, you know, guess what? There's no media there for me. And I can, you know, walk down the street and run into people that I know or not know, and that's my interaction with people. And I, frankly, I don't need the internet if I absolutely had to do without it.
Okay, well, Michael, any comment?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting that mention of the Sabbath, because I know some people have actually taken up a concept of people who aren't Jewish or even religious have taken up an idea of a digital Sabbath, that one day a week they just don't go online at all. And it's for all those reasons that your caller was mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to be dictated to by some algorithm. They want to preserve some level of intellectual independence. So I think that's great.
Okay, thank you, John.
No problem. Have a great day. And remember, be independent and ask questions.
Okay. All right. Let's talk to Lynn in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Bonnie. Thank you, Michael. I'm really thrilled that you have explored this and written this book. I'm 72, so I belong to the generation that had peace and quiet. And I take a walk every morning before work, or I go to a yoga class on my days off. And I certainly don't want to be interrupted by a cell phone in the middle of a walk. And I see people with babies on their cell phone, not talking to their babies, not pointing out the egrets and the beautiful sky, and it just makes me very, very sad. I also am a licensed clinical social worker, and I have a meditation group that I have every week for, I'm an oncology social worker in a hospital, and invite people to come and meditate. And I love my house quiet as a tomb, except right now while I'm eating lunch, I'm listening to NPR, and I do that on my way to yoga. But every once in a while, I turn off the radio, and I just go quietly. So there's so many situations I don't want to be interrupted. So I just carry my cell phone in case I get stuck or something, mm-hmm. and never have it on. So it's wonderful to do both. I love to look up things on my computer, but I love quiet and peace.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
Well, thanks so much. Oh,
I don't know what that is. Thanks so much for calling, Lynn.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Michael, any comment? Because obviously there are so many advantages to the internet. I mean, what Lynn's saying, she uses it, you know, sparingly, but enough.
Well, exactly. And I love hearing stories like that. And it's people like that, people who have lived on both sides of the internet, who can teach us so much about the values of absence and solitude, and or just a bit of attention instead of living in constant distraction. I agree, and I love that idea of having the phone in your purse or whatever, but having it off so that you can use it, but you're making the choice instead of letting a world of contacts choosing when you will and will not be distracted.
We're speaking with award-winning journalist Michael Harris about his book, The End of Absence, What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. We're going to take another short break on today's Topical Currents, and we'll be right back.
get a handle on it, you Google, you blog, you tweet, 'cause you're hooked on it. Boss ain't ready,
Freddy.
How you gonna help him see? Social media, it's hip, it's even addicting. It's hot, it's cool, it delivers top-notch search placement. I kinda like it. Social media's the boss.
And thanks to Paul Leary for these musical selections. By the way, we'll have links to them on our website with today's show, which is Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman with Michael Harris. He's written The End of Absence, What We've Lost in a World, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. And the number, if you want to join in, 1-800-743-9576, or tweet us at Topical Currents or radio@wlrn.org for email. Yesenia tweets, she says, people often get upset with me because I disconnect sometimes, which is a really good point, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we've created a sort of expectation of constant reactions, and people do, they take umbrage if you opt out of that kind of thing.
I mean, I know if I want to get in touch with somebody, and because, you know, you have your home phone, you have the cell phone, you have email, and then you don't hear from them. And I understand that person that wrote you and said, are you alive or what? You know, we've all been there, right? Okay, so, Michael, what would Henry David Thoreau do if he were born today and not 150 years ago? What would he do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think he
what
would
do you
take,
think he would do?
I think he would take a year or two off. Offline to reconnect with himself. I mean, that's what he did when he wrote Walden, right? He walked away from the city. He walked away from what he thought of as, he talked about railway fashion, because the railroad was the big connecting technology in his time, and that was pushing things too far for him. So he had to go out into the woods and build that cabin. But, you know, the important thing about Thoreau remember is that even when he stepped away from the city and went to Walden Pond, he still visited, and he had visitors come to him. It was never about abstinence. It was about trying to reconnect with himself so that he could connect better with other people. And I think that's one of the things that I was trying to get across when writing The End of Absence was, it's never about technology good or technology bad.
Right.
It's always going to be about that healthy media diet.
Well, you have a great quote at the beginning of your first chapter, Melvin Kranzberg. It says, technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral.
That's the key thing, is just because something is neither good nor bad doesn't mean it doesn't have an effect. And we have to be intelligent about what that effect is. I mean, a knife is amoral also, but we need to know how to use it.
Let's talk to Tori in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Tori. Welcome. Tori?
Hello.
Hi, are you there?
I am.
Okay.
Hi.
So are we.
First, let me say thanks. I'm really enjoying this conversation. I grew up in foster care, so most of my connections were superficial most of my life. When I turned 18 in 95, I immediately got into computers, got into technology, and that's where I got all my knowledge. That's how I'm self-taught, and I put myself through a lot of stuff and got very successful in a lot of ways through social media and things like that. Unfortunately, now it's distinctly an addiction. I can tell. I've worked 100-hour weeks from 18 to 28. It wasn't until then that I finally decided to take some time off because I recognized it was a problem. But now that I hear this guy's to the digital Sabbath and, you know, someone disconnecting and deciding to go, you know, live in the woods and build a cabin, things like that, I don't know if that's the direction I need to go to that extreme, but I'm curious what kind of path someone like me, who's spent his entire life online and connecting to people on a superficial level through social media and the internet and things like that, could learn how to move forward. You're saying there's two distinct differences, people who were before the internet and people who are after the internet. Well, I'm definitely one that's after the internet, and I'm curious where to begin.
Any advice, Michael?
Sure. I mean, it does come down to realizing we have to engineer absence into our lives now, right? It used to be that you could just passively wait for those empty moments in your life, and then you would kind of have a default daydreaming position. But there's always going to be something to distract you now. So you have to actually take charge and be active and engineer those moments of absence. And we can do those in lots of ways. One way is just alone or with our families to take that digital Sabbath to say, like, hey, every Sunday afternoon, we don't go online. We do something as a family. Or you can do something more extreme like I did and try and find like a whole week or a whole month off to really shock your system, I guess. But even in smaller ways, you can also do things like batch processing your email. So looking at how many times you check your email a day, like count them up, and then cut that in half. Because if you're checking your email 10 times a day and you go down to 5, I can guarantee you, you're not actually going to lose any productivity. If anything, you're going to gain productivity. We think we're being very busy when we go online and we check our email, but the statistics show us that, in fact, every time you do that, you're derailing yourself, and so you're actually not being a multi-tasker. You're just being a multi-switcher, and it's very different.
How does that sound, Tori?
That makes sense. I've been trying to do some things, like I try to step out in the meditation and things like that to make these kind of moments. And it's distinctly challenging, and I think that has something to do with, like you were saying, the brain's kind of been wired this way for so long, you know, allowing children to get access to this kind of stuff early on. Like I said, this is the only thing I've known my entire adult life. It's the first thing that I did, you know, and still currently do. So I guess it's just a matter of practice.
Right. Well, there's also, Michael, I guess a good time to talk about Analog August. Tell us about that. And it's sort of like a challenge. I guess it's Penguin, Current and Penguin that's doing this?
Exactly. Current is my publisher. They're an imprint of Penguin. And people can go to analogaugust.com to check this out. But it's a challenge that Penguin and myself have put out to people in the United States. Where we're asking people to try taking one weekend off from the internet. And if you accept the challenge, you fill out a little form on that website, Penguin will actually send you a Penguin Classic for free. So there's that little incentive. One of the books that they can send you, actually, I think, is Thoreau's Walden. Or if you're really looking for a challenge, they can send you War and Peace also.
Right. Okay. So that's Analog August. We'll have a link to that, by the way, analogaugust.com. So it's to disconnect for one weekend in the month of August, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly. And we're also looking for people to, after they come back online, shoot us an email and tell us about your experiences, and we'll post some of our favorite ones up on the website.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling, Tori.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And Midnight Mutineer tweets that, what about those of us working who can't disconnect?
Right. Well, and that's where it comes down to that idea of approaching things as, developing a healthy media diet. It's not about abstinence, right? You don't have to disconnect completely to correct your media consumption. So if I'm going into the office, yeah, I might have to be on email so that my boss and my coworkers can communicate with me, but I don't have to check my Facebook page every 10 seconds while I'm at work, which is what most people do. In fact, providers of social media tell us that the peak time for using social media websites is actually during office hours, not after. So we know that most of us are goofing off online part of the time that we're at work. So there's always ways that we can make corrections and improve those media diets.
And one more tweet before we take our break, and then we'll come back and take more calls. Alan Paul says, I wonder how you, Michael Harris, respond to the educational system's use of social media. Is it affecting their ability to learn?
It's a really good question.
Yes.
This is something that needs a lot of study, because we sometimes think just because we can do something, we should do something. And there have actually been some schools that have been gung-ho at bringing iPads into the classroom, other schools that have actually put bans on cell phones. My personal bias is probably getting to be kind of clear. My personal bias would be toward leaving the cell phones in the lockers. But even more important than that, I think, is that we need to actually bring media studies and technology studies into our curriculum. Every class that has a language arts program, I think in high schools and even in elementary schools, we need to start teaching them how technologies change the way that we see the world. Just as much as we teach them how literature works, we need to teach them how a Twitter feed works. Not just how to use the internet, but how to see themselves using the internet.
Exactly. We're speaking with Michael Harris. He's written The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection on today's Topical Currents. One more short break, and we'll be right back and take more calls. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Michael Harris, an award-winning journalist and contributing editor at Western Living and Vancouver Magazine. Who's written The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. And the website for that is theendofabsence.com, correct, Michael?
There's no the. It's just End of Absence.
Oh, it's just End of Absence. Okay, I got that wrong.
Yeah.
All right. And then the analog August. We'll have all those links on our website for you. Let's talk to Maureen in Boca, who's been waiting quite a while. Hi, Maureen.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
Yeah, hi there, how are you? I just wanted to thank Michael for writing a book like this, and I've actually given some consideration to writing a book about my experience, which was similar. I went through a period recently where I had an injury which required me to have multiple surgeries, and during that time I went through sort of a self-imposed absence from the social media. Prior to that time, I was pretty involved in Facebook and various other medias. And after the incident, I stopped going on Facebook and all that sort of thing after surgeries and different things like that, just because, well, I was too sick. And also, I just didn't want to go on there for privacy reasons. And I found that one of the things was there was a big backlash from a lot of my friends, you know, kind of angry at me as to why I wasn't posting, you know, how I was and all that sort of thing. And it was pretty annoying, you know. And I posted on there saying, if you want to know how I am, call me. You have my phone number, you know.
Right.
You know, I don't necessarily want to say how I'm feeling. This is kind of a very private time of my life, and I'd rather you call me and pick up the phone and you know, talk to me. This is some time when I need friends to converse with me or come and visit me, and not just, you know, go on a computer and be so unpersonal. You know what I mean? It's so, that's the thing about the computer. It's not a personal media. It's so technical. It's so non-personal, and people have lost that connection. You know, they think that because they're on a computer and they're liking or they're posting that they're connecting. And the truth is that we have lost that connection with other people. And I realized that when I went through a major crisis in my life, the real people in my life were there for me. And the quote unquote friends on Facebook were angry at me because I wasn't posting. And I just wanted to comment on that because
that's such a good point, Maureen. And it addresses something in this book. Michael, talk about the irony in our relationships with social media.
The irony. Which do you mean?
The fact that, like Maureen was saying.
We're connected.
They're not friends.
But we actually create this,
they're not
this
friends. Yeah. They're fake friends. They're like, they're these air friends. If they're real friends, they're going to pick up a phone, or they're going to come and visit you, or they're going to send you a real card in the mail. They're not going to bother you on Facebook and like say, why aren't you posting, or why aren't you giving us an update as to how you're feeling? Why should I have to post how I'm feeling? Why can't you ask me how I'm doing?
Right.
You know, and a more personal level. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Why email? You know, there's still the old fashioned way. And at my age group, people know how to do those things. You know, I'm not 20. You know, people still know how to do those things. And that was sort of an interesting thing.
Okay, so, you know, thanks for calling, Maureen. Any more comment, Michael?
Oh, I was just going to say, one of the chapters in the book is actually about evolving ideas around authenticity. And that's what I was thinking about when Maureen was talking, was what is an authentic connection? I mean, I remember going to Paris for the first time, and like all the other tourists, I climbed the Eiffel Tower, and when I got to the top, I was looking out over this beautiful city, having this incredible moment, and my first reaction wasn't just to take it in and have that authentic connection with the landscape, but I wanted to take a photo and send it to my boyfriend, because that was the only way it would be a real moment. It was sort of one of these if a tree falls in the forest moments.
Right.
And I really did end up, I guess, forgetting what a real authentic connection to the moment would look like in that moment.
Yeah, that's a great point. I was going to ask you, well, let's take a call from John first, who's been waiting a long time in Pembroke Pines. Go ahead, John. I'll save my question. We are getting near the end of the program, though, so if we could keep it brief, that would be great.
Hi, am I on? Bonnie and Michael?
Yes, you are.
Hi, Bonnie. Thank you. I like your show. Michael, I'm glad you wrote the book. And I'll take my question off there because I know you're short on time. I wanted to get your opinion about the fact that government and everything is pushing us towards having to be online, having to be connected, and almost like we're going to a paperless environment. And it's very it's disconnecting so many. And again, I thank you for your program, and I'll take your comments on the end.
Okay, that's a great point, John. Thanks for calling, Michael.
What the consequences are of,
well,
being,
he's saying
being forced
how
online by government?
Yeah, I mean, government, everything. I mean, banking, you know, everything is encouraging us. Companies are all encouraging us to be online. Everything is encouraging us to be online.
And they're doing this, we know, because of the advantages of data mining for them, right? We know that if you can monitor every click that somebody makes, that's incredibly valuable information, especially for advertisers, so that they can target advertising to you. So while these things are very efficient and they can save us a lot of money, certainly government forms becoming online forms instead of mailing them back and forth, like these things are just inevitable. But while it happens, we always need to be keeping a safeguard up, where you have maybe civil liberty organizations watching out for us to be sure that our data and our privacy is never being impinged upon.
And we'll take one more call, because that's all we're going to have time for. Renee in Miami Lakes, welcome to Topical Currents.
Hi there, Bonnie. Really quick. I think that I'm in my 40s. I intentionally am not connected to any of the systems of Facebook or whatever it is that's out there. I just believe in privacy. And I think that's something that a lot of people have forgotten, or growing up not knowing that it's available. Why should I post everything? And just like the other lady that called in, you know, I believe in the old-fashioned way. You want to get a hold of me? You call me. I'd love to hear from you. I call people. Now I'm having to text people because people don't even answer the phones anymore.
Right. Michael?
So, yeah, I think that we have arrived at a point where we have a culture of what's called life logging, which is this desire to show people everything that you're doing. And this is people who like take photos of their desserts and throw them online or comment on the latest True Blood episode online. it ends up being it encourages us to believe that the only way that our lives matter is if other people know about them. And I think that's a kind of adolescent standpoint that we can that we're better than.
Okay, Renee, thank you for calling.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. So do you think it's just a matter of taking responsibility? Is that really what it boils down to? Would that be the takeaway, making more conscious choices when we are digital, when we're connected and when we're not?
It's engineering absence in our individual lives, engineering absence for our children especially, because they're the ones who don't have those pre-internet brains. And it's also encouraging each other and our school administrators to bring some media studies into the curriculum so that we can educate ourselves about all these issues.
Well, before we go, I just want to confess something. This never happened. I was reading your book, and well, Michael knows this. I was reading this book, The End of Absence, on Saturday and was halfway through it or three-fifths of the way through it, noticed I had dog-eared every page. And because it is so replete with research and scholarship and interesting facts that I, in frustration, called Michael Harris on Saturday and said, I can't come up with how to distill everything in this book. So the point is, and thank you, Michael, for sending the that little thing, but the point is that the book is really interesting and has a lot of research and a lot of science and a lot of great interviews. And so I just want to say that I recommend it. And before you go, just tell us one more time about Analog August.
Sure. This is a program that myself and Penguin has put up for August. We're inviting everybody to take one weekend offline this August, and anybody who does it and fills out the form at analogaugust.com before they go offline, we'll send them a free copy of their choice of one of five Penguin classics. So you get a free book for the deal.
Then you can even read the actual book.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay, Michael Harris, an award-winning journalist, a contributing editor at Western Living and Vancouver Magazines, has written The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. Thanks so much, Michael. It was very interesting and a lot of fun.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our program for today. We thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction and musical selections from our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow's Topical Currents is another edition of our monthly series, our new series, All in a Day's Work. We'll find out what it's like to navigate the skies with pilot Bruce Bornstein. Bonnie Berman, hoping your day is a really good one. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.